Okay. So first I want to thank the organizers for granting me this award and giving me the opportunity to present my paper today. So sorry. I'm not sure how to. Okay. That is fixed. Let me get the presentation. Okay. No technical difficulties anymore. So the paper that I present today is joint work indeed with Bas Werker and Theo Nijman, both also from Tilburg University. And to sort of link the paper to what we saw earlier today, we had a presentation by Ethan, and he was talking about this product which sort of combines health insurance and an annuity. And while this is indeed a really good idea, I think it would be well for improving, but what we see in reality at this moment at least, annuity markets are incomplete, these products are not sold, and the sort of the downside of annuities is that if you need liquidity, you cannot resell your annuity, so there's no way to get liquidity if you need it. So what we look at is whether full annuitization is still optimal if individuals face background risks and incomplete annuity markets. So if an individual faces background risks, such as health costs, which is out-of-pocket medical expense, which is mainly the case in the U.S., or you could also think of, for instance, breakdown of a durable. You need to buy a new car, or your washing machine breaks down, so you need some liquidity. Or your child needs a loan. You can think of many background risks that individuals face which raise the need for liquidity. Furthermore, another reason why full annuitization might not be optimal can be that individuals, they want equity exposure, for instance, and variable annuities are not sold in the market. So incomplete annuity markets, so only, for instance, nominal annuities are sold, can sort of decrease the optimal annuity demand. And this is a question that we examine. So in our paper, we only look at the retirement phase, so from 65 onwards. It's a life cycle model, and we include the most important risks that a retiree face. So longevity risk, the risk of outliving your assets, we talked about this this morning. Capital market risk, inflation risk, and of course the background risk. So the theory, sort of the classical work, says full annuitization is optimal. And as Ethan indeed told, this is in the classical paper by Yari, you see that if the only risk that individuals face is longevity risk, they want to annuitize everything. But the thing is, what you see in reality, that individuals rarely annuitize. For instance, in the US and the UK, you have the choice whether, if you have accumulated the pension wealth, you have the choice either to take the lump sum or an annuity. And what you see that people do, they often take the lump sum. So sort of this discrepancy between what we see in reality, there are only a few people annuitize, and what we see in theory, that full annuitization is optimal, this discrepancy is called the annuitization puzzle. And why is then so important to examine the optimal annuity amount? Well, for policymakers, it's a key issue to examine whether stimulating annuitization or even imposing annuitization, whether this is welfare improving, because now there's more the tendency to going to giving people more choices, giving them the option to take a certain amount as a lump sum or to even take everything as a lump sum. But if we know from theory that this is very costly in welfare terms, we might be thinking about even not giving them the option or at least stimulating annuitization. Furthermore, also from sort of the seller of the annuity perspective, it's important to know what is the optimal annuity demand. When you're giving advice to individuals whether to annuitize their wealth and are thinking about how much to annuitize, it's important to know what is the optimal amount. Is full annuitization optimal if individuals face background risk? Or if the only thing that they can buy is a nominal annuity, well, what they want is a fixed income stream in real terms. And also the welfare effects of annuitization are really large. Can be up to 40%. So it's a vital topic to examine. What is then the fundamental trade-off? What are the advantages of annuitization and what are the disadvantages? Well, the advantage, of course, it provides longevity risk insurance. So you do not run the risk of outliving your assets. And furthermore, and related, of course, to this, the return is enhanced by the mortality credit. So the basic idea is that the assets of the dead are transferred to the living, which generates additional return. And that is why an annuity is an attractive product. Well, what are then reasons that people might not want to annuitize? Maybe what have been examined, for instance, by Mitchell, Paterba, Warshawski, and Brown. So it's maybe actuarially unfair annuity marks. The load is just that high that you don't want to buy them. But what they find that this is not the case. The welfare effects are also just that big that you want this product. Another reason can be the class motives, but also there's a paper by Brown and he examines whether people without children or people with children, whether they leave a different bequest. And they find no significant difference. And then of course having children is a proxy for having a bequest motive. It can also maybe be that high pre-annuitized wealth levels. If you already have 80% annuitized, maybe that's the optimal amount. But if the optimal amount is, of course, 100%, then still you would want to buy additional annuities on top of the pre-annuitized. But what we examine in this paper is whether background risk is a reason to decrease the annuity demand. Maybe can this explain the annuity puzzle? Or maybe incomplete annuity markets is a reason. The paper closest to ours is by Emmerich, Kaplan, Laufer, and Van Nieuwenberg. And what we do, our background risk is not it's not health cost risk, it's an age-independent background risk which we model. But Emmerich, they model background risk explicitly as health costs. And what they find is that annuity demand actually falls due to health costs, due to out-of-pocket medical expenses. But the main difference between their paper and ours, and also I have a paper where I explicitly model health costs, but I'll go into more detail later. But they have extremely high health costs early in retirement. So health costs can be, for instance, 50,000 for subsequent years already at 65. And this is crucial, but later on I'll explain why this is crucial. So the health costs early in retirement, why this is crucial for annuity demand to fall. Other papers related by ours are by Pang and Warshawski, Sinclair and Smethers, and Yogo. And for instance, Yogo, he models health costs as endogenous investment in health. So we are talking about exogenous background risk, and you can just invest in health. What we find, so our contribution, we find that full annuitization remains optimal. And different to, for instance, Pang and Warshawski, we model annuitization as a one-time decision. So at 65, you have a certain amount of retirement wealth, and you're going to decide what to do. What amount are you going to put in annuity? What are you going to have liquid? And the reason why we do this is that at first selection, problems actually, they increase with age, so the load gets higher the older you get. And also, I think retirement is a natural decision to think about how am I going to provide for myself for the coming years until I die. And in our paper, we optimize over consumption and we optimize over savings and also the asset allocation, but I forgot to put that there. So first, the main findings. So full annuitization remains optimal. And so this background risk and the lack of equity exposure, the incomplete annuity market, it does not decrease the annuitization level significantly. But what individuals do, they start building up a buffer. They just save out of their annuity income to build up a buffer to ensure against the background risk, to have a smooth consumption pattern, and to invest in equity. So they annuitize everything and then start saving and create a buffer. Well, we then looked at whether adding variable annuities to the menu, does it increase welfare significantly? And we find that this is not the case. So just to be clear, a variable annuity is an annuity which has exposure to the equity market. So this is a way to get equity exposure without saving and then investing in the equity market. But what we see that adding variable annuities to the menu does not increase welfare significantly. Individuals just save and invest that in equity and they're almost just as well off. So the outline of the remainder of the talk. So first I'll talk briefly about the model, briefly about the method. I'll elaborate a bit more on the results and I'll end with a conclusion. So two equations, the objective is to maximize the real consumption, the expected real consumption over the lifetime, discounted by the survival. It's discounted by beta, the time preference discount factor, and P is the survival probabilities. And the intertemporal budget constraint is the following: so wealth at time t plus one is equal to wealth at time t plus the annuity income y minus the expenses due to background risk and minus the nominal consumption, and this is equated by the return on the portfolio. And remember, we optimize over the asset allocation. So we have two assets, equity and a riskless one-year nominal bond. We use the VASI-check model for the term structure. Inflation is stochastic, so individuals face inflation risk. The background risk is stochastic, age-independent, so it's not really similar to the health cost risk, because then you see that, the health risk increases sharply with age. And the annuity is an actuarially fair single premium annuity. So first, we're going to define what we call the full real annuity income. This is just, we're going to normalize this, so everything will be in terms of this full real annuity income. So the full real annuity income is the real income for the rest of the lifespan if everything is invested in a real annuity. So you're 65, you have, for instance, 100,000, everything is invested in a real annuity, and you receive this full real annuity income, and we set this equal to unity. The rest of the parameters are standard in the literature, so I'll sort of skip them. But the important part is the expenses due to background risk. So I'll tell a bit about them. So they're log normally distributed with a mean of 10% of this full real annuity income, and the standard deviation is equal to 7%. And it's the subsistence consumption level is equal to 15% of the full real annuity income. So if individuals do not have enough wealth to consume, enough wealth that is above of this 15%, they get this subsistence consumption level. So we optimize over the asset allocation WT, and we optimize over the real consumption. And we have three state variables. So we have two exogenous, the inflation, and we have the risk-free weight. These are the two exogenous state variables, and we have the endogenous state variable, wealth. And we use a numerical solution because we cannot solve this problem analytically. So we use the simulation-based method by Brandt-Goyal, Santa Clara, and Strout. And we use the endogenous grid method by Carroll because we have our endogenous state variable. And we use several extensions by Ralph Koya and my two co-authors. So if you have been sleeping, this is the main result. So just wake up now. This is the only graph you really need to remember. So on the horizontal axis, we have the annuitization level. On the vertical axis, we have the certainty equivalent consumption. And the certainty equivalent consumption is just, we calculate it to be able to compare the stochastic consumption patterns. So if you have, for instance, a consumption pattern which fluctuates over time, we calculate which consumption pattern that is fixed over time makes you equally happy. And this is called the certainty equivalent consumption. So let's look first at the case of the real annuity without background risk. So this is for the dashed line. If an individual annuitized nothing, he has a certainty equivalent consumption equal to 0.5. If this individual invests 100%, he has a certainty equivalent consumption of 1. And this is, of course, this is very intuitive because we defined the full real annuity income, which we set equal to unity. So, of course, it should be equal to 1 here. And what you could also see from this graph, that the welfare gains from annuitizing are substantial. Because if you annuitize nothing, you get 0.5 times the full real annuity income and certainty equivalent consumption. But if you annuitize everything, you get double. So the welfare gains from annuitization are substantial. But now we talked about an individual who can invest in a real annuity and doesn't face background risk. But now let's look at what happens if we add this background risk to our model. And we can see this result when we look at the solid line, our benchmark case. Well, we see that Of course, the surgery equipment consumption drops here, because first this individual didn't have to pay these expenses, and now he does have to pay these expenses. But more importantly, what we see is that the surgery equipment consumption is essentially increasing in the annuitization level. There's the more this person annuitizes, the happier he is. So we see that even if an individual faces background risk, he still wants to annuitize almost fully. Now we're going to look at the other part of the question. So whether if an individual can only invest in a nominal annuity, so annuity markets are incomplete, does this decrease the optimal annuity amount? And we can see this result when we look at the dashed dotted line, is the line below. And we see that, again, the certainty equivalent consumption increases in the annuitization level. And 100% of annuitization is optimal. So even if an individual faces background risk, and he can only invest in nominal annuity, he wants, so he cannot get equity exposure, he cannot get inflation protection, still he wants to put everything into this nominal annuity. Now we're going to look at the vital part of why this result holds. Because we optimize over consumption, we optimize over savings. So what this individual does, he creates a large buffer to insure against these expenses and to invest in equity. Now we're going to focus on the reasons to save if an individual invests everything in a nominal annuity. So there are four reasons. So we have the anticipatory motive due to inflation, and this is just because, let's say inflation is fixed, and if you have a nominal annuity, this provides a decreasing income stream in real terms. Well, what you want is a smooth consumption stream, because we have that the return, so the risk-free rate is equal to the time preference discount factor is equal to the real rate, which for this reason we want a smooth consumption pattern over time in real terms. So what you want to do, you invest everything in nominal annuity, but you want to shift your income from early retirement to later, because then your income in real terms is low. So this is the first reason. The other reason is the precautionary motive due to inflation, because if you face inflation risk, this is in effect a background risk. So you're also saving due to this. The third reason is, of course, the background risk which remodeled. And fourth, to obtain the desired equity exposure you're saving. So what we're going to do is disentangle these four reasons and get a better sense of what is important. Why do you want to save? So let's first look at the solid line. We have on the horizontal axis age, and we have on the vertical axis the optimal real wealth. And the solid line is for the full model. So all the four reasons to save are in this graph. And you see that the individuals save substantial amounts out of the annuity income to create the buffer. It says it's max, say, age 82, and then he has optimal real wealth of about 3.5 times the full real annuity income. So let's now look at what is due to the anticipatory motive. So to look at this, we're going to look at this dashed line. This is for an individual who doesn't face the normal background risk. He cannot invest in equity, it's not available. He doesn't face inflation risk. Inflation is deterministic. So the only reason to save is just to shift income from now to later. And what we see, he saves substantial amounts just to this anticipatory motive, to, let's say, about 1.5 times the full real annuity income. Now let's then look at how much does he save due to the inflation risk. We can look at this by comparing this solid line with the dots with the other solid line. And because with the solid line with the dots, this is the full model, but we excluded the inflation risk. So by comparing these two, we can assess the increasing savings which is induced by the inflation risk. And you see that this is a substantial amount. So a large part is due to this inflation risk, which is in effect where we see a larger background risk than the background risk which we model, because the increase in savings is larger here than between these two lines. Because if we look at the dashed dotted line, This is for an individual who doesn't face background risk, and then his savings are only increased by this amount. Well, if he doesn't face he does face inflation risk, his savings are increased by this amount. So what we find is that inflation risk is a really important reason to save, and also background risk and equity exposure are a large reason, but not as large as the inflation risk. What you then wanted to look at is whether if you add variable annuities, so equity-linked annuities, to the market, does this increase welfare significantly? And this is not the case. We see welfare gains of about between 1.1 and between 1.5, depending on the assumed interest rate and depending on whether individuals face background risks. So adding variable annuities to the market doesn't increase welfare significantly. So also in this sense, incomplete annuity markets do not matter if you cannot invest in variable annuities. What we did in a subsequent paper, now our background risk is age independent, but we wanted to model it explicitly as health cost risk. So we used the estimates by Donati, French, and Jones, and these are the same estimates that Panalaszarski used in their paper. What they find is that out-of-pocket medical expenses increase sharply with age. So the health cost risk at the beginning is not that high. It gets high after, let's say, age 80. And they find that medical expenses and survival probabilities are negatively correlated. So the basic idea is, if you have high medical expenses, you're more likely to die. So that's the basic idea. But what we find is that actually the findings, our results do not change. Full annuitization is still optimal. And the reason why we find this result and Emmerich doesn't find this result is because the health cost in early retirement cannot be that high. So we have enough time to build up a buffer to have enough to ensure a smooth consumption pattern if hit by large health cost shocks. But in Emmerich's paper, the health cost can already be really high early in retirement. So you do not have enough time to build up a buffer, pay the expenses, and get a smooth consumption pattern. So whether full annuitization is optimal, it depends critically on your ability to save in the early retirement years. So the wealthier you are, of course, the faster you build up the buffer. So the amount of health costs in early retirement years and the probability of getting, of course, these high health costs. And what we did, we developed a rule of thumb for the optimal annuity demand. So we have this big life cycle model. We cannot solve it analytically, but we built a simple model based on these three statistics, and we looked at whether we can approximate the annuity demand well, and this is indeed the case. So this simple rule of thumb, it can replicate the results from this full complicated life cycle model. But this is in another paper. So the conclusions. So full annuitization, it remains optimal even if individuals face background risk and incomplete annuity markets. But this is conditional on optimal saving strategies. So from a policy perspective, when you're imposing annuitization on people, you should also stimulate optimal savings behavior, because if people annuitize everything but they do not save, they do not create this buffer, then if had by these large shocks, then they have almost nothing to consume. So combining these optimal these high annuitization levels, stimulating them, it should also be combined with stimulating savings, optimal savings behavior, so high savings. So the minor result is what we find, that adding variable annuities to the menu, it doesn't increase welfare significantly. So the main sort of policy recommendation is that you should advise to people to annuitize a lot, but combine it with optimal saving strategies. And annuities, when you do it correctly, when you combine it with these strategies, it can be substantial welfare gains. So thank you. If you have any questions.
Inflation perspective, how do you know what the inflation will be when you start
Yeah, but the idea is a bit that there's sort of this break point, because the survival probabilities, they induce you to consume more today because it's sort of an additional discount factor. So that's why if you're say 80, there's a the survival probability they keep decreasing. So you tend to decumulate after this, after a certain age, because then the probability of dying, the additional discount factor gets so high that you consume more today compared to tomorrow. So does that answer your question? I see a sort of non-satisfactory face.
I'm not sure when you can reach that point, though. Like, if you don't know if it's going to be 20% next year, and every year after that, what point do you know you're saving?
But that's also, you never know when enough is enough. But there's what you do is you build up a sufficient buffer that there's, for instance, only a 5% probability of getting sort of that the wealth comes under a certain level. So you save sufficiently that you think there's a large enough probability that you do have enough money. That's also what people, I think, intuitively do.
True.
But a lot of people indeed in also actually they die in debt. Oh sorry, they die with wealth, so you know, the unintended bequests. And there is sort of what is oversaving, what you're doing is you're ensuring a smooth consumption pattern over time, and in utility terms this is what you want. You don't want to run a large risk of having only the minimum consumption level when you're a certain age. So, indeed, there it's not oversaving, it's just creating the optimal buffer that you're not scared of consuming only the minimum level. Sorry. Yeah?
And if you're in your model, since you're not constrained, that gives now your physical strength, you allow borrowing against the annuity.
Oh. A good question, but no, we do not allow borrowing against the annuity income, because then people could just, if they're hit by large expenses, borrow against it. And no, that's we do not allow that. Sorry, I didn't include the description of the model was a bit brief. I agree.
Why?
Why it was brief?
I didn't. Why don't you allow it?
Oh, because I think it's a realistic assumption. People, I don't think you can go to a bank when you're 80 and say, I have this annuity income, can I get a certain amount of wealth to pay my medical expenses? I don't think it's, banks would want it, but I don't think it happens that people borrow against their annuity income. That is sort of the rationale behind this choice.
Okay. For instance, how sensitive your results are to change in your emotional parameters. For instance, I remember that you had something like the minimum
First, the reason why we chose this 15%, because it's realistic for the US, but I agree, for instance, I think in Canada it's not realistic, also not for the Netherlands where I'm from, but we doubled the minimum consumption level we did for business staff. And still these results hold. But it is correct that minimum consumption level is vital, because in the other paper we look at health cost risk, and then the risk can be really, the expenses can be really high. So the probability of hitting this minimum level are higher. And what we then see is what is vital is sort of the difference between this minimum consumption level and your normal consumption level. Because the higher this difference is, the more unhappy you are if you hit this bound. So the minimum consumption level is important, but not particularly for this paper, because it's almost never hit. Because we have the 7% standard deviation, so let's say we hit it three times, it's almost a zero. Of course, if I would make it if I would make it 50%, the standard deviation, it would definitely matter, the minimum consumption level. But I think for the US, this is a realistic assumption.
Inflation is bothering me.
Is it too high or?
just within my experience, there are periods when it very clearly has been desirable for somebody not to annuitize. This has actually observed inflation because the loss due to inflation is so large. And so I'm wondering what were the numbers you were using for inflation? Yeah.
The mean inflation rate is 3.48. This is all from US data. And I think the standard deviation is 2%. And it's an AR1 process. So periods with high inflation will be followed by other periods with high inflation. So the inflation risk is really important. And you also see that in the savings behavior, because people save like hell to insure against this risk. So I agree that inflation risk is really important. And there, I can imagine if today, for instance, there would be 10% inflation and I would be offered a nominal annuity, that I don't want to buy it because if I have subsequent years of this inflation, maybe not optimal at this moment. But
yeah, okay, I guess in that case, then the savings will have to be very high to protect against that, but
yep.
Consumption, I don't know, in other words, the consumption level you're expecting signs for you to start at, they're actually going to be consuming at half that level.
Sorry?
At half that level.
No. There is indeed in the start you save a substantial amount, but still it's I think about in the start like 20% of your annuity income you save, and once you hit a certain buffer, your savings decrease. I didn't include it in the presentation, but it's in the paper.
First of all, people have any choice, they actually have enough money for this, or they're better off in society. A large chunk of people have no such choices. But if they do, they probably have owner-occupied housing. And that provides your buffer.
Oh, you mean the reverse mortgage, that you would, if you need the liquidity, just...
Reverse mortgage, or trade down, or simply systematically move into, the biggest cost outside of the U.S., which is, the biggest cost in civilized countries is the cost of assisted living at the end, at which point the natural liquidation is that.
Yeah, but I agree with you that this would provide a good buffer, but first of all, reverse mortgages, they're really expensive, and it's sort of a different paper looking at this. And I can already intuitively, I know the results. It's optimal to use your house as a buffer against the expenses. Because you're going to this assisted living, you don't need your house, you provide for this assisted living. But they're not sold that often and they're expensive. So we didn't incorporate it because I think the results will be intuitive also. Thank you.
Thank you very much.